You're listening to the Restless Wanderer podcast by Paul Coulter, and this is part 26 of a series in John's Gospel. John chapter 10, verse 1. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. This figure of speech Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So Jesus again said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. For this reason, the Father loves me, because I lay down my life, that I may take it up again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father." There was again a division among the Jews because of these words. Many of them said, "He has a demon and is insane. Why listen to him?" Others said, "These are not the words of one who is oppressed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind?" At that time, the Feast of Dedication took place at Jerusalem. I will end there at verse 22 of John chapter 10. Now, the mention of the Feast of Dedication, I read into verse 22, and we'll read it again when we come to the next episode and finish off chapter 10. But the Feast of Dedication took place about 3 months after the Feast of Tabernacles. So back in chapter 8, we were at the Feast of Tabernacles. Then we had the incident of the man born blind in chapter 9. And then we come straight into this teaching in chapter 10, which clearly has a new theme, the I am the good shepherd. And we see that there's a 3 month gap, and we don't know whether the man who was born blind being healed happens. It happens sometime in those 3 months. It could be that it happened at the same time as Jesus said these things in chapter 10. Certainly in verse 21, people remember that event, or it could be that there's a gap between the two. I suppose it doesn't really matter which it is. But here we have another one of these I am sayings of Jesus. Or in fact, we have two which are very closely related images. In verses 7 and 9, we read about Jesus as the gate of the sheep. And in verses 11 and 14, Jesus describes himself as the good shepherd. And these, I suppose, are two I am sayings. People often say there are seven sayings. The bread of life in chapter 6, we've seen already. The light of the world in chapter 8, and again repeated in chapter 9. And now here, the third and the fourth, the gate of the sheep and the good shepherd. In chapter 14, it's the way, the truth and the life. Chapter 11, it's the resurrection and the life. And in chapter 15, the true vine. But of course, we also saw at the end of chapter 8 how Jesus said simply, "Before Abraham was, I am." So we know the significance of that phrase, "I am," by this stage in John's Gospel. We know that Jesus is identifying himself with Yahweh, the Lord, the one who said to Moses that say that I am has sent you in Exodus chapter 3. So here is Jesus now using this phrase again, and he's describing himself in terms of the door or gate of the sheep, and also as the good shepherd. But we've got to begin at the beginning of the chapter. And again, the context here is the man in chapter 9 who had been put out of the synagogue by the Pharisees and Jewish religious leaders who opposed Jesus, but who was accepted by Jesus because he declared that he believed in Jesus and worshipped him as the Son of Man. So the sheepfold is in view, and the image here is of a flock, and this is a familiar image. Usually behind these I am sayings are familiar Old Testament images. If we think about the light of the world, then light is an Old Testament image for truth and revelation from God. The vine is an Old Testament image of Israel, and of course the flock is an Old Testament image of Israel. And God is the shepherd of Israel. Each one of these images identifies Jesus both with Israel and with God. And in the person of Jesus, the wonderful thing is that God, the shepherd of Israel, becomes Israel, becomes the one faithful Israelite. Jesus represents the whole nation in his faithfulness to his Father. And so we have these sort of twin applications. In some cases, the I am saying by using this phrase I am, and in this case by identifying himself as the shepherd. And even those who are not very familiar with scripture will often have heard the most famous of Psalms, Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, David says. It's not the only place where God is described as the shepherd of Israel. In some of the other Psalms, Psalm 100, for example, Israel is described as the flock of God, the sheep who he shepherds. In the prophet Ezekiel, there God talks about the false shepherds who have been the leaders of his people, and how they have fed themselves on the sheep and they have mistreated the sheep. Ezekiel chapter 34, and God says that he will come and will reunite the flock, will gather the scattered sheep together, will bind up their wounds, will carry them tenderly. The prophet Isaiah uses a similar image as well. So this is a rich Old Testament image when Jesus begins to speak about the flock. But the flock needs a sheepfold, a fold where it can be securely kept. But he who does not enter by the doorway, but climbs in over the wall, presumably by another way, is a thief and a robber. But the one who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him, the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. Now, again, you've probably, if you're familiar with this passage and you've heard it preached on, you'll know that it's important to transfer ourselves into the ancient Middle East, the time when Jesus was alive. Our image of shepherds today, often in many parts of the world, certainly in my part of the world here in Northern Ireland, you can't really get the imagery here, because shepherds in our part of the world don't tend to lead their sheep. They herd them from behind, maybe with a dog or with a quad bike or whatever. They round them up. They don't know their sheep in the same way. They don't live close to their sheep. They let their sheep live out in the wild because we don't have the same predators, at least again in Northern Ireland. We don't have large predatory animals, and I presume in other places where they do, like the USA, for example, then they fence the sheep in. They use other ways to protect the sheep. But the shepherd in Jesus' time lived out in the field. The shepherd was responsible for defending and protecting the sheep against the wolves and bears and other animals that would have attacked. You read about this in the Old Testament, in the life of David, when he was a young boy tending his father's sheep. He fought off those wild animals to protect the sheep. And so there was a relationship. The shepherd would walk at the front and the sheep would follow. He would know them each by name and they would know his voice, just as Jesus describes here. So this is a resonance for the original hearers with their life experience, with what they knew of shepherds. And the resonances between what Jesus says here and Ezekiel 34, of course, is strong, isn't it? Because there you had leaders who were actually calling themselves shepherds of the sheep, who should have been taking responsibility, but were destructive. They were like the thief and the robber. The thief and the robber were the ones who came before Jesus, verse 8. The thief comes to steal and kill and destroy. The thief wants to make himself rich on the sheep, and he will do that in the most brutal and effective way he possibly can. There's a big challenge here, isn't there, for leaders, particularly in the church? And no doubt that application is in Jesus' mind, because pastor or shepherd, pastor meaning shepherd, is a term that's used for leaders of the church. Or rather, maybe leaders isn't the most helpful word, but those who care for the church, who oversee it, who guide it, and they are called to be shepherds like Jesus. And Jesus is saying that the leaders in Israel have been like thieves and robbers, making themselves rich, feeding themselves on the sheep. But if those religious leaders had been the faithful under-shepherd that they were supposed to be, if they had been the gatekeeper, verse 3, the under-shepherd who was temporarily guarding the gate, or perhaps making himself the gate, because remember Jesus says, I am the gate, or the door for the sheep. Well, if he hears the shepherd's voice, he opens the gate, and the sheep hear Jesus' voice, and he calls his own sheep. The sense here is perhaps of a shared sheepfold, a pen where different families would have kept their sheep together. Would of course be more economical to have one large fold and different and one gatekeeper who was paid to do it, and the shepherds, the owners, would come and call their own sheep, and the sheep would recognize their voice. Nowadays here in Northern Ireland, you drive around the countryside, you see sheep that are sprayed with different colors to distinguish them, but they didn't need that in Jesus' time. The sheep would have known the voice of the shepherd. And apparently this can still be observed in the Middle East today. You can still see shepherds who can call their sheep, and their sheep will follow, and the ones who aren't their sheep won't follow. They can separate out the sheep in that way. Although there's a little beautiful addition here, that it doesn't just say that they know his voice, but he calls his sheep by name. The idea is of an individual relationship, a name for each sheep. In the sense that each one is precious to him and is known to him. And you can see the resonance, of course, with the parable of the lost sheep in Luke chapter 15, the shepherd who goes after one sheep that is lost, because he knows each sheep individually. Each one is precious to him. The shepherd leads his sheep. A stranger they won't follow, verse 5, they'll flee from him. They don't know his voice. But they don't understand, verse 6, as so often in John's gospel, there is a misunderstanding. It's a figure of speech, but it is not understood by them. They don't grasp what Jesus is talking about. And this, of course, is a sign that they don't hear his voice. They don't recognize him. They are not his sheep. The parable is being enacted even in their lack of understanding. But Jesus speaks again in verse 7, and he begins to explain. He says, first of all, I am the door of the sheep, verse 7. And it's important to notice here, this is not simply a retelling and a developing of what's said in verses 1 to 5. It's actually a richer picture, because there the shepherd arrives on the scene, and the gatekeeper, the temporary gatekeeper, opens the door. That's what's happened in Jesus' time. Of course, the gatekeepers, the ones who called themselves the gatekeepers, didn't open the door. John the Baptist, perhaps, is the true gatekeeper. He opened the door wide and made way for Jesus. The religious leaders who were trying to oppose Jesus were the thieves, the robbers, making themselves, they didn't want him to lead the sheep away. So verses 1 to 5, in a sense, talk about the coming of Jesus. But then what Jesus does with his flock is developed in verses 7 onwards. He becomes the door. There is no longer, at this point when Jesus is on earth teaching and calling disciples and forming them into a community, he becomes the gate of the sheep, the door. He himself is the one who puts himself in the doorway between them and harm. Again, you may be familiar with that description of there may have been a stone wall with a gap that was just big enough for the shepherd to sit in. To sit down with his knees bent and maybe to sleep there resting against the wall, but he himself became the gate. The ones who came before were not the true shepherd, but he is the door. And so people, anyone, verse 9, the individual again is in view. If anyone enters by him, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pasture. Here is the individual invitation that those who believe in Jesus, like the man who was born blind in chapter 9, or the other disciples of Jesus, they have entered in to a new sheepfold through Jesus. He is the way in to God's flock. Jesus is forming together a new people of God, and he himself is the entryway into this new people of God. And to enter through him is to have salvation and a rich and full life, a life of going in and out and finding pasture. It's not a life of being constrained, but of freedom, not a life of limited horizons. Come to Jesus and have your life hemmed in, but it's a life of freedom, but also of security. And Jesus calls this, verse 10, he says, the thief just comes to kill and destroy, but I have come that they might have abundant life, life in all its fullness, that they might have life abundantly. It's a beautiful picture. Sheep who are well fed, well provided for, carefully tended, protected, their wounds are bound up. This is the life that Jesus calls people into, the life that he offers, the life that if they could only have seen in the experience of that man in chapter 9 who was born blind, the life that he was beginning to experience. A life of restoration. He received that restoration of sight in this life. Of course, for many of us, that full healing, even for him, because he went on to die, awaits the future when Christ returns in glory, doesn't it? But that life begins now in the experience of those who come to Jesus. Jesus hasn't come to ruin life, to spoil life, to lessen life, but to restore and to bring fullness of life in relationship with him. But how is he going to do it? Verse 11, well, he is the good shepherd. And the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He had the hired hand, verse 12, who doesn't own the sheep, runs away from the wolf and allows the wolf to get to the sheep because he doesn't care about them. But the good shepherd knows his own, verse 14, and they know him just as the Father knows me and I know the Father and I lay down my life for the sheep. Here is this beautiful sacrificial love, knowing love of Jesus for the flock. He's not going to abandon them. He's not going to run away when the wolf comes to destroy. He will stand before the sheep to lay down his life. He will suffer for them. He will die for them. Jesus, of course, knows that the cross is coming. He knows that his death is in view. The false shepherds will not give their lives for the sheep. They're not going to die for their sake, but Jesus will die for the sheep. And in that context, Jesus introduces his relationship with his Father. Again, we see this throughout John's Gospel. We've seen it already. But when Jesus comes to die for his sheep, to bring them into the fold, He comes to bring them into the intimacy of relationship with him that he enjoys with his Father. Jesus is bringing us into a new kind of relationship with God. We mustn't lose sight of just how revolutionary this is. The Old Testament, of course, is wonderful in the relationship it describes between Israel and God, the covenant relationship, God's committed loving relationship with that nation. But what God does in the New Testament is much greater. Because it's only through the incarnation and the coming of the Son into the world that we can come into relationship with the Father through the Son as an intimate relationship of closeness through the forgiveness of sins because of the death of Jesus and the indwelling of the Spirit, who, of course, is not mentioned in this passage, but who will come up later on in John's Gospel. Jesus lays down his life for the sheep. It is through sacrifice, through his death, that he will bring about the salvation that he's talking about. And verse 16 then, he says, I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice, and there will be one flock, one shepherd. Here, of course, the Gentiles are in view. Jesus' flock is not just going to be those from Israel who will believe in him, but the gospel will go to the Gentiles, not in Jesus' lifetime, but through the apostles who he has appointed and who he is training, these under-shepherds who will go out. They will become shepherds of the flock. When we get to chapter 21, we'll see how Jesus commissions Peter, the restored Peter, after his denial of Jesus. He gets restored in chapter 21, and Jesus tells him to feed his sheep. He will become an under-shepherd. The leaders of the church will become under-shepherds, and they're called to love the flock the way Jesus does, to know them, to lay down their lives for them sacrificially. You can see that in the New Testament when it describes the role of elders and shepherds and overseers in the church. There is a constant emphasis on sacrificial commitment. People don't take up that role in order to gain for themselves, but to lay their lives down for others. But the oneness of the flock, the one shepherd, is incredibly important. Here is the unifying vision. It comes up again in chapter 17 as Jesus prays for the church, prays for us, and his prayer that we might be one so that the world can see that we are his disciples and that God sent him. One flock. How tragic it is that the church has and continues to divide into factions and segments and denominational labels and so on. And I'm not preaching against churches collecting together in denominations that are like-minded, but if we're going to do that, we mustn't do it in a way that undermines the vision of unity. Too often churches end up in competition with one another, not speaking well of each other, not seeking unity. There is only one shepherd. Christ remains the chief shepherd, to use the language that Peter uses in 1 Peter. Peter, who gets appointed at the end of John to become a shepherd, will talk about Jesus as the chief shepherd. But this is why the Father loves him, verse 17, because he lays down his life that he may take it up again. It's not that Jesus is going to disappear as the shepherd. It is that he will rise from the dead. Of course, the resurrection is in his mind here. Jesus lays it down, but he will take it up again. No one can take it from him. He chooses to lay it down, verse 18. Here is the one who is in authority even over his own death. And we can't begin to think of our own deaths in those terms, can we? Death is an enemy that comes upon us. We can't choose it, I suppose, unless we end our own life, and that's not something that is given us to do. But that's not what Jesus is talking about here. He doesn't end his life, but he allows others to have power, to have authority over his life. But make no mistake about it, that the death of Jesus is no defeat. The death of Jesus is something that has been planned, something through which God has a greater purpose than those who unwittingly make it happen, the betrayer and those who put him on trial, and Herod and Pilate who condemns him. They are actors in a greater purpose that God has had, the purpose that Jesus knows he has, to lay down his life. But he also has authority to take it up again. The Father has given him this authority. This is how his relationship with his Father will work, that he can lay his life down and he can take it up again. And so he remains the shepherd of the sheep, not the historic figure who began the church and then handed it over to others to carry it on as the shepherds. The passing on of authority in the church is not some succession of apostles or some succession of popes who are seen as the shepherd of the church, but Jesus remains the shepherd of the church, and all who serve as leaders in the church are merely his under shepherds, and they must learn not to be hired hands but to love the sheep as the true shepherd, the good shepherd, does. But they must also learn to introduce the sheep to him so that they come into saving relationship with him. And as usual, the result of this, there is again division because of these words. Many say he's a demon and insane, why listen? And others say no demon-possessed person can speak like this or open the eyes of the blind. The divisive Jesus, the Jesus who, as we saw in chapter 9, has come to bring judgment, who will separate those who trust in him from those who reject him. The Jesus who is calling people not to simply respond in some superficial way to his call, but the Jesus whose call divides and separates and calls people to lay down their life to follow him, to take up their own cross, to become his disciple. Look at this chapter again, read over it, and think first of all, is Jesus your shepherd? Do you hear his voice? Do you listen for his voice? Have you come to him, come through the gate to receive his salvation? And if so, then are you listening for his voice today? Because he remains the shepherd, you know. He's not just there to rescue you and save you, but to lead you as the good shepherd into green pastures and beside still waters and through the valley of the shadow of death. But if you, in any measure, are a shepherd of others, an elder in the church, a pastor, a leader in any part of the church's ministry, then are you becoming a good shepherd like your shepherd, Jesus? Are you loving the sheep? Are you prepared to suffer for them? Are you laying down your life for them? Are you relating to them? Are you binding up their wounds? Or have you or I perhaps become a hired hand who runs away, or worse still, a thief who is making ourselves fat on the sheep instead of feeding them? Look to the good shepherd, the one who is the gate and the shepherd for the sheep, the one who is forming the church, the one who is bringing others in. And why not ask yourself, who is missing from the little part of the flock that is your church? And who is it that Jesus would bring into that flock? And how is he going to do it? Well, it's going to be through you and through me bearing testimony to him, isn't it? He continues his work of saving people today, but he's going to use us to bring them to him, to introduce him to them. Let's do that, for he is the Good Shepherd.